And welcome to another edition of the Odyssey Radio Show. This is your host, Mike Schultz. We talk about ancient and modern mysteries. Tonight I have a really fantastic guest for you to share his knowledge. His name is Jack Barringer, college professor, and he's written a great book called Past Shock. So welcome to the show, Jack Barringer.
Thank you.
Thank you very much. Why don't you first talk about your book as a play on words, and it refers to future shock. Why don't you talk about what future shock is first?
Future shock, Mike, is the fear of the future. It's one of the key words there is overchoice. People get overwhelmed by the fact that there are so many choices to be made that they don't know which ones to be made. And I guess you could call it the quickening. Things are just happening too fast. And in past shock, this also deals with overwhelm. This deals with a period of history in which a number of shocks happened, and these shocks are in our collective unconscious.
Absolutely. So why don't you tell me about your background? I know you have a fairly traditional background. And when red flags started to occur in the official story about the Garden of Eden and Adam and Eve and sin and the story that most of us were told.
Oh, gee whiz. I think I began falling apart in seminary. I was in a fundamentalist seminary, and they told us that they wanted us to read 1,000 pages a week. And extra, other than the assignments, and I started reading about some of the other ancient books, and I began to get different stories, and you might say my faith was rattled.
Okay, so this goes back quite a ways, when you were a student.
Yes, this goes back to 1970.
Okay. Well, let's talk about some of these ancient documents. Tell us about the Atrahasis, what that is, and how it relates to the Bible.
The Atrahasis actually supplies us with what is the missing link, because in the Atrahasis they are saying they're trying to prevent a mutiny. The men are here. Well, I should say the Anunnaki. Should I explain that?
Sure. Go ahead and tell us who the Anunnaki is. We deal with it on the show, but we always have new listeners.
Okay. The Anunnaki were here 400,000 years ago, and they were mining for gold to keep their atmosphere warm. And they were from the planet Nibiru, and that went in extreme ellipsis around the sun. And they
came here for minerals.
They came here for minerals. Have you ever wondered why gold is so scarce?
Yes. Or why it's always been so important to humanity.
Yeah. Well, anyway, they came here, and all of a sudden, as the gold was getting rarer and rarer, they
it was harder to get, correct?
It was harder to get, and they had a mutiny on their hands.
Absolutely, yeah, it was too hard to dig for all that gold. So what happened at that point?
So they said, let us make ourselves a lulu. And the lulu is the Sumerian word for primitive worker. And they engaged Ninhursag and planted a fetus of a Neanderthal man in there, and voila, there was born the human race, Homo sapiens sapiens.
Absolutely. So tell us about the Atrahasis. There are some biblical Old Testament stories in those clay tablets, correct?
Yes.
Which ones?
Well, one thing the Atrahasis has is the serpent is the hero. The serpent is telling the truth.
Right, he's trying to liberate Adam and Eve in the Garden of Eden.
He wants to liberate Adam and Eve, and he believes in the spiritual potential of humanity. And this is a Sumerian named Enki, and he comes in as the serpent and tells them to eat of the fruit of the tree in the middle of the garden, the knowledge of good and evil. And this really fires up Enlil, his brother, his half-brother, and he is enraged. And, if you go back, Enlil, who eventually became Yahweh, told Adam and Eve not to eat of the fruit of the tree of evil, or the tree of knowledge of good and evil. And they said, even if you touch the tree, you will die. And what happened is that Eve decided she wanted to try some, and she said, this tastes good. And she didn't die. So somebody was lying there.
Absolutely. But the bottom line is that the Atrahasis gives a great more detail to the Old Testament stories, does it not?
It does. It does. It's called the subtitle is the Babylonian Book of the Flood.
Now, do you know any traditional mainstream churches that will deal with these documents?
None.
So it's all just relegated to mythology then?
It's relegated to mythology, but I believe it's history.
I do too. Oh, we're on the same page, believe me. And I think it's a lot of effort to chisel on a clay tablet. It's not just like writing on a piece of paper.
Well, the person who did the translating was a man, I'm sure, who is familiar to most of your audience, is Zachariah Sitchin.
Of course.
And Zachariah Sitchin was the only... He was one of the rare men who knew Hebrew fluently and knew the Sumerian language fluently. And he translated the cuneiforms into the book of Atrus.
Right. So traditional mainline Christianity has no comment then, really, on the Atrahasis.
Christian has no comment?
So what about the flood story? The flood story and Noah's Ark is also in the Atrahasis, correct?
Okay, well, the flood is one of the areas where I try not to lose my temper. Because they knew the flood was coming. And Enlil wanted to rid the earth completely of human beings. In fact, he made the... His exact words were, their conjugations deprived me of sleep. And so he just figured the flood would take them all out. And Enki went to a man named Utnapishtim and told him to build an ark. And Utnapishtim and Noah are probably the same people.
That would make sense, yeah.
I don't think there were two arcs.
No.
And Enki saw the value. He saw a spiritual value in the human race. But Enlil didn't like the humans at all. In fact, he had a contempt for them that was vile.
Right. Now, the main point we have to make right away about all these pretender gods is they have nothing to do with the supreme god of the universe, correct?
They have nothing to do with it.
Absolutely. They are God's children like we are.
They are not God's children like we are.
Do you feel they're imposters, then? Is that How do you separate them between us being God's children and they are not?
I think we picked it up right away. And when they created us, we, for example, in the Tower of Babel, we built a city and a tower, and Zachariah Sitchin said that was a rocket launching pad because they were going to go to Anu and complain that the prime directive was being violated and that they were being violated and they were being treated very badly. And the
Anunnaki destroyed the Tower of Babel.
They destroyed the Tower of Babel, yeah.
And what's interesting is they dispersed humans to the far corners of the earth and scrambled their languages. Isn't that an interesting strategy?
They not only scrambled their languages, they destroyed the cities, they scattered them all over the earth, and it was history's first dumbing down.
So this is one of the shocks you talk about.
This is one of the big shocks. I don't think we've recovered from that one.
No, I don't either. Now, talk about Jehovah in the desert with the Jews for 40 years. He is apparently in a portable tent the whole 40 years, correct? He is never seen by the Jews?
He's never seen, but his ship is seen because his ship shoots light down, and he says, follow the light. And he has a sort of an ancient type of spacemobile, and he just says, follow that, and I'm wondering why they're marching at night anyway. I mean, the Israelites said, we were better off back in Egypt than we want to go back.
Yeah, he had a very love-hate relationship with the Israelites. Now, when there's all these verses in the Bible about the elaborate preparation of meat and lamb and rubbing it with oil and slipping it under the tent, what is that, just a mundane way of him getting dinner?
I'm sorry, I misunderstood that.
All of these animal preparations and sacrifice and giving them to Jehovah, is he just basically having humans provide dinner for him?
Yes. There's one where they actually put them in a bag and they shake it with flour and everything, and it's the first, history's first shake and bake.
It's a recipe, then, that he liked, huh?
Yeah. There is a verse from the Bible where a tongue shoots out and consumes, the 12-foot tongue shoots out and consumes the prepared sacrifice. I believe, just as you have pointed out, that this was dinner, that they were teaching them how to prepare dinner. And they go in the book of Deuteronomy and Exodus, it goes into long diatribes about how to prepare it and how not to over-prepare it.
Yes. I remember learning this in church. And what always interested me is the Supreme God of the universe was so angry and jealous of the bronze snake that the Israelis were worshiping, like a bronze statue?
The golden calf?
Yeah, the golden calf, I'm sorry.
Yeah.
I mean, why would the creator of the universe be jealous of a golden calf?
Well, evidently he didn't make much of an impression, even with the miracle of the Red Sea. And when Moses was gone, the people melted all their jewelry and made a golden calf. They wanted something to worship, something they could see. They couldn't see Jehovah.
Right. Now, what about all of these, the destruction of cities like Sodom and Gomorrah and Jericho? Talk about those shocks.
This is a shock that I really don't know much about Sodom and Gomorrah, except that I was there when I was in Israel, and the place is just, nothing will grow there.
Still to this day.
Still to this day. In fact, you could take dirt from Sodom and Gomorrah and mix it with regular Nothing will grow in it. I think it's radiated.
Right. The Bible talks about brimstone, fire, and pillars of salt, and perhaps that's a description of a nuclear war or bomb?
I think it was a nuking, but I don't have much company on that one.
It sounds like some kind of advanced technology.
Yes, it's definitely enhanced technology. There was one point where 250 people were walking up to complain to Jehovah, and Jehovah opened the earth, and flames and brimstone shot out, and the 250 people were consumed by fire.
Right. And what about the Ten Commandments? He gives Moses the main commandment, which is thou shalt not kill, but then what does he order Moses to do?
Jehovah broke seven of the Ten Commandments. And I think the only reason he didn't break the last commandment, thou shalt not covet thy neighbor's wife, is because he didn't like women.
Uh-huh. But he definitely ordered Moses to kill the Hittites and the Canaanites and to take their land.
Yeah.
Right after giving him the orders not to kill. So it just doesn't make a whole lot of sense. But, you know, as we're growing up in Sunday school, I never really questioned any of this, to be honest with you.
You never questioned it when you were growing up?
Not as a child.
No, I didn't either. I didn't question it either. I didn't question it until I got to seminary.
Yeah, absolutely. Much later. I was just fearful of the Jehovah of the Old Testament. Just fearful. And I loved him at the same time.
Well, one of the things that, as a little child, that got me was when Uzzah was trying to save the Ark of the Covenant. They were walking along, and the thing was going to smash into 100 pieces, and he went up to stabilize it. And he was, shall we say, electrocuted?
Right.
And Jehovah said he was punished for touching the Ark of the Covenant. And I remember in the Gregory Peck movie, did you happen to see that?
No.
David Bathsheba?
No, okay.
Well, Gregory Peck touches it and nothing happens to him.
They changed it, huh? Well, there are several examples of very minor transgressions where human beings are killed by Jehovah. What are a few of the other ones?
Well, one time a man picked up a stick on the Sabbath and he was stoned to death.
Right, for picking up a stick.
For picking up a stick.
I know another one got in great trouble for trying to look at Jehovah, or trying to see him.
Boy, you got me on that one.
Yeah, and I think what they would have seen is somebody who looked pretty human, correct?
Well, I think his face shone because Moses' face shone when he came back.
Right.
For a few days.
So there was something different about the Anunnaki. I believe they were tall, like giants.
Yeah. Christian O'Brien has written a book called The Shining Ones, and he thinks that they were special and that the shining made them special.
Right, and they could also be benevolent as well. Jehovah could reward behavior when he wanted to.
The benevolence came from what William Bramley referred to in The Gods of Eden as the Brotherhood of the Serpent. There were a group of Anunnaki who really wanted to see the humans make progress, and they taught them how to write, they taught them agriculture, they taught them math, and they taught them skills that they would need so that they would be able to build buildings and so forth. The whole architecture was another thing they gave them.
Right, and these became the first mystery schools of Egypt, correct?
Yes.
And is that where you believe the Freemasons got their start?
I honestly don't know. I know that Hiram Abiff is the hero of the Freemasons, and he died he was beaten to death keeping the secret of the Freemasons on how they built those buildings.
Uh-huh. He never revealed it, huh?
He never revealed it. Nobody ever revealed it.
Okay. Let's tell everybody the name of your book again and how they can get it.
Okay. The name of the book is Past Shock, and the sequel to it is The Origin of Religion and Its Impact on the Human Soul. And both books will, well, the second book will be available in about 3 weeks. I'm reading the galleys to it right now, checking in for mistakes.
Great.
But Past Shock, you can get by calling 1-800-700-TREE.
And that's the book tree out of San Diego.
That's the book tree out of San Diego.
You can go to a search engine, Yahoo or Google, and type in the book tree.
Yeah.
And get their phone number, Past Shock by Jack Berenger.
Yeah.
Okay, let's move on to some of the Mayans' ancient tablets and texts called the Popol Vuh. Tell us about that.
Well, in the Popol Vuh, it's very interesting because they had a hard time in creation. They wanted to create a being that was reverent, obedient, worked hard, and didn't give any guff at all to the things. And they went through six creations until they finally got what they wanted. And they referred to these men as the men of wood.
Okay, so they were also, in the Mayan text, looking for a worker, correct?
They were looking for a worker, yes they were.
So even though it's a different continent and thousands of years difference, it's the same basic idea here.
Yeah.
So what else does it describe about the Anunnaki and the Popol Vuh?
There's nothing described about the Anunnaki and the Popol Vuh because they're far apart. The only thing is that they made a mistake. The only link to the Anunnaki that they have is they made a mistake during one of these six commissions and created a very superior human being.
Someone who could challenge
them. Scared them. In fact, this really scared everybody. This scared them in the Garden of Eden. This scared them in the Tower of Babel. They said, now they can see like we see.
Right. Now, scientists tell us that we don't use, 90% of our DNA? They call it junk DNA. Is that what you believe was turned off at some point?
I believe it was cut.
I do, too. Yeah, it all makes sense. Isn't it interesting how everything falls into place? And what about the missing link?
The missing link, I think, is us.
Right, but scientists have never understood it.
Well, you're not going to get much help from scientists because they're still looking for the missing link. They in no way think that there were extraterrestrials here on the planet.
Right, that's pretty far outside the box.
That's far outside the box.
Yeah. Okay, let's move over to India and talk about very ancient texts called the Mahabharata.
Okay. Well, the Mahabharata is the thing that talks most about flying saucers. They were called Vimanas. But the Mahabharata is long. Which part of the Mahabharata do you want to talk about?
Talk about how the gods interacted with mankind.
Well, the gods treated them pretty bad. I can refer to one conversation between the hero of the Bhagavad Gita, which is part of the, which is part of the Mahabharata. And there's a conversation between Arjuna, who's the hero, and Krishna, who is the god. And Krishna wants, Krishna has made peace with his uncle. And, Krishna made peace with his uncle?
Yes.
Arjuna had made peace with his uncle.
Right.
And he said, I don't have to fight anymore. And Krishna just went ballistic. And he said, no, I want you to go down there and kill all of those people. I want to see you fight in battle. I want to see you be a hero and so forth. And this is in the Mahabharata, but not in the Bhagavad Gita.
Okay.
And I think it's in the 10th book where he is pleading in tears, I don't want to kill my uncle. And Krishna says, if you're to be a hero, if you're to be my hero, you will kill not only your uncle, but all the people down there. And they had an expression that is used in the Bible, so that nothing is left breathing.
So it's similar stories, but in India, they kept their beliefs in polytheism, didn't they? They always believed in many gods, a whole family of them.
Yes, they did.
Whereas in Western culture, when did this shift take place to all consolidation into one pretender Anunnaki god?
I honestly don't know that one.
I don't either, but it sounds like
I know they got it down to three.
Right.
Shiva, Krishna, and I can't think of the other one.
Uh-huh. Is it Ganesh?
Was it what?
Ganesh?
That wasn't Ganesh.
Okay, that's the elephant human one. What do you make of a lot of these gods appearing as half animal, half human? What do you make of that?
What do I make of that?
Yeah.
They really considered sacred the animals. And I honestly don't know why cattle are still sacred today. If a cattle moves down the road, people get out of the way and doing all that. And I honestly don't know why they switched to animals. But I believe one thing. These animals that they refer to in the Mahabharata and the Bhagavad Gita, I believe they existed because they were doing, they were playing around with biogenetics.
Absolutely. My research indicates they were mixing hybrids and
yes.
Genetics before the flood.
Yes, I believe there really was a unicorn.
Right. Now, and most of these hybrids got killed by the flood. Don't you think they tried to start over at that point?
I don't know if they were put on the flood, if they were put on and saved, or I know that a lot of these hybrids died in the flood.
Right, and the giants, I know that they talk in the clay tablets about how they eat so much, and they're very difficult to manage.
Yeah.
Now, what about Egyptian society? They certainly had very elaborate beliefs. Their main god was Ra, correct?
Ra, yeah.
And a lot of female goddesses. And were they merely explaining how they interacted day to day with the Anunnaki? Was that what they were referring to?
I think so. They did come down and talk with the, just like with the Hebrews, they did come down and talk with the Egyptians. And, they even offered some of them godhood.
Right, the priests and the pharaohs.
The priests and the pharaohs, yeah.
Could take a journey to the underworld and hopefully make it to, possibly the home planet, to immortality. Now,
that's what they believed, anyway.
Yeah, exactly. When do you think the Anunnaki stopped appearing in public?
Somewhere around 800 BC.
What occurred at that time? A particular incident, or they just faded into the background?
Let me ask you a question.
Okay.
Have you heard of Ronnie James Dio?
Yes, I have. It's a singer in a rock band, yeah.
Yeah. Ronnie James Dio has a song called And the Fools Sailed Away.
Okay.
And I use it as part of my speech. And if you notice in the Bible, if you notice in mythology, that at least in the Middle East, there were no gods after 800 BC.
Right.
And Julian James wrote a book about this period called The Origin of Consciousness and the Breakdown of the Bicameral Mind. And he says that for 2,000 years, humanity was in a state of mass psychosis because there were no gods on the planet.
Right. We were looking for new direction at that point.
Yeah. And so, they tried all sorts of ways, and that was born, I guess that was born, things like the Oracle of Delphi and so forth in Greece, but that was too late.
Right. Now, the Greeks certainly referred to Zeus and Apollo and Athena as all of these gods that they interacted with. Were they also referring to the Anunnaki?
I do not believe they were friends of the Anunnaki. I think the Anunnaki sort of kept to themselves. I don't have a very high opinion of the Anunnaki. I think they're scum.
Well, they certainly did shock us in many different ways.
I'll give you an example. Athena offered Odysseus immortality, and he turned it down. And the gods were giving favors. I think Athena and Minerva. No, wait a minute. I'm getting my Romans and my Greek gods mixed up here.
Well, they're very similar.
Yeah.
The Roman and Greek gods have a lot of correlations.
Yeah, but they did good things for the Romans and the Greeks.
Right. But a lot of these stories could very well be based upon fact.
Yeah.
Now, what about, there's a book that almost made it in the Bible, but not quite, and that is the Book of Enoch. Why don't you explain what's in that book?
In the Book of Enoch, did you say?
Yes.
You're talking about my favorite ancient book.
Okay, go ahead.
In the Book of Enoch, that is where we got our concept of hell. Because Enoch was taken of a tour where the children of the Anunnaki were being punished. And he said there were flames shooting out, brimstone was flying all over the place. And he fell in absolute terror. And he was told by the angel Gabriel, he said, I know how we can control the population of Earth. Well, what we can do is just get these people to battle each other and they'll kill each other off.
Right.
And that's
a shocker right there.
Yeah, he said here, you must take action against the bastard children who have become reprobates, the children of fornication. Destroy all the children of the Anunnaki. Set them against one another so they will kill each other in battle. For they will not have long life, and no pleading which the fathers make shall be listened to.
Now, there's a trial in the Book of Enoch, and a lot of the Anunnaki got in trouble for having sex with humans, correct?
Yes, they sure did.
What was the outcome of that trial?
The outcome of that trial?
Yes.
It didn't stop them one bit.
But weren't a group of them sentenced underground?
Well, the outcome of the trial was that they went to Sheol. And Sheol and hell sound... There's enough that Sheol and hell could sound the same. Because the Anunnaki who took the earth women and found them fair and married them...
Yes.
They were sent to Sheol, and this is the place where the fire and brimstone was, and they were put to hard labor and so forth.
So, do you believe there's an actual underground place that they're referring to?
I don't know if it's underground.
Uh-huh.
I just know that Enoch was taken there, and he was terrified of what he saw.
Absolutely. Well, we're winding down now. Is there anything you'd like to add about your book, Past Shock?
I would like to add that I have a sequel to Past Shock, which is called The Origin of Religion and Its Impact on the Human Soul, and it will be out in about 3 weeks. And you can call that same number. Can I give that number again?
Please, go ahead.
1-800-700-TREE.
Well, Jack Berger, author of Past Shock, I appreciate you coming on, and we'll look forward to the new book.
I had fun, Mike.
Thank you so much.
Okay.
Go ahead and hang up, and you can clear the line.
Okay.
And I'll talk to you later. Take care. Bye-bye.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you. Okay, there goes Jack Berger. I just read his book, actually. He sent me a nice advanced copy, and very intriguing for those of us who grew up in traditional churches, and to kind of look behind the scenes in the Old Testament and get a bit more information. Now, for the remainder of the show, I'm going to get into these animal-human hybrids that we touched on during the interview, because it turns out there's a whole world of these creatures that have always been thought of as mystical or mythological, and I believe, once again, they may have been based in fact, because we do know that the Anunnaki were geneticists, and that they may have been tampering with human and animal DNA and genes at that point. There's certainly very little skeletal evidence of these creatures today, but I think there was back then. So let me read you some of my my notes from my one of my future DVDs that will come out, and I'll comment as I go along. Let's take a look at the text of Gilgamesh. This is an ancient text, and it describes animal and human hybrids. These clay tablets date back to 2600 BC and describe Gilgamesh's adventures and quest to be immortal. There's that theme again, humans wanting to be immortal. He describes a kingdom below the earth, a fearsome place of darkness and terror. A wide range of beings inhabit the place, known as the Kigal, or Great Below. And we just talked about this with Jack Berger. The same place is referred to in the Book of Enoch. Artificial or robotic beings, known as the Galater, were sent to the surface by the kings of the world to kidnap humans or perform tasks and errands. These beings bear a striking resemblance to the robotic gray aliens that we see so much of in today's UFO literature. This type of being could be based in the underworld, with its home in the underworld, not another galaxy. Another strange being is called the Utuku, which is an eagle-headed type of reptilian human. They possess wings and the ability to fly, and also perform tasks for the rulers of the underworld. The Pazuzu is yet another strange creature with the face of a dog but with the body of a reptile, with scales and a tail. As we look into animal-human hybrid creatures depicted throughout the ages in mythology, we will come across beings that are similar in appearance to these underworld dwellers. Indeed, they could be the actual basis for the unusual animal humans that have came to be a part of mythology. It's also important to note that in the East, there are strong beliefs in an underworld that is inhabited by a race of half-snake, half-humans known as the Nagas. Indians and Asians believe that a very advanced race with highly developed technology dwelled below the earth. They also visit the surface to torture and abduct humans, and also interbreed with humans according to their ancient traditions. Medieval books are full of drawings and descriptions of animal-human hybrid types of beings. These documents are known as bestiaries, an old type of encyclopedia that describes different species of animals. So a bestiary often documents many strange creatures that are commonly thought of today as mythological. As I go ahead and describe some of these hybrids, it's going to be tempting to merely assign them to the realm of pure mythology. But remember, these were strong beliefs of ancient cultures. Let's talk about the Amamet first. Every year, many people are killed on the Nile River, even today, by crocodiles and hippos. What the local Egyptians also report is that there is a creature called an Amamet, which lurks below these waters. It has the body of a hippopotamus and the head of a lion, with a long reptilian tail. He hides by the tall reeds of the river and grabs human prey with his powerful jaws, dragging victims underwater. The ancient Egyptians documented this legendary beast in their artwork. The Amamet is featured in the Book of the Dead. He sits beside 42 gods of the jury, who are judging the worth of a human soul. Amamet devours the hearts of those who are judged guilty, and delivers them to the underworld for final death. He is also featured in the ancient temples and artwork of Egypt. The Chimera. Another creature from ancient times is known as the Chimera. He is a three-headed monster with the body of a lion, a goat's head emerging from his back, and his tail is a deadly snake. According to legend, this beast could blast a hot flame from its mouth to burn victims. The Chimera is described in a similar fashion in Homer's Iliad. According to this tale, one of the Greek heroes ascended upon the flying horse Pegasus and killed the Chimera with an arrow to stop his terrorizing of the Greek citizens. This long-lost creature is rarely reported today, but was said to inhabit remote caves in Turkey and Greece, which still contain scorch markings on the walls from the blast of the hot flames. Sightings of a Chimera have long been omens of natural disasters such as volcanic eruptions and storms. Okay, let's talk about sirens and harpies. The strange legend of the harpies are depicted in antiquity as having been the creature has the body of a bird with the head and breasts of a human female. They generally had an evil or hostile mood and were known to prey on lone travelers or children by the sea or countryside. Victims speak of a foul odor that the harpies emit, which cause nausea and helplessness. They gather in groups of 20 to 30 and often scavenge food storage bins or outdoor picnics for food. In Greek mythology, the king Phineas was overtaken by a group of harpies who attacked this city. This was a punishment to the king for revealing secrets of the ancient gods to mortal men. Remember, the Anunnaki don't like it when you give out too much information to humans, as Enki the snake did in the Garden of Eden. So here's this common theme once again. Jason and the Argonauts traveled by ship to save the day. They drove off the scary bird women with their bows and arrows, chasing them off to sea. Pliny the Elder wrote a book of natural history around the time of Christ, and he mentions harpies. According to Pliny, they were sighted near India by traveling companions of Alexander the Great. The Sumerian clay tablets describe a type of bird-human creature known as a pazuzu. We talked about that earlier. Ancient statues survive to this day of a being with large wings and claws with talons on its hands and feet. This could possibly be the actual genesis or basis of this creature, who was later transformed by mythology into the legendary harpies. Another related bird-human hybrid is known as the siren. This creature has the head of a woman and the body of an eagle. She is known by sailors across the globe for her enchanted songs that she sings to entice men to leave their ships and follow her. You've all heard of the siren song, that's where it comes from. Greek mythology is filled with tales of the siren, who was said to be the companion of the goddess Persephone. When she was carried off to Hades, the sirens developed wings to follow her. These hybrids were a great danger to sailors all around Greece. Odysseus was able to avoid the hypnotizing songs that beckoned him by plugging his ears with wax. Jason lost one of his Argonauts years later when the sailor followed the siren's song to his death. Several of the sirens were said to have committed suicide after Jason escaped, as they are highly strung. Once again, sirens are featured in medieval bestiaries and were sometimes confused with mermaids. They are listed in a 17th century book called Johnston's Birds, but there are no modern sightings today, despite legends of their existence off small islands near Italy. One strange, unsettling fact is that approximately 36 mariners vanish without a trace around these islands every single year. The Basilisk. One of the most sinister hybrids I came across in my research was the basilisk. It has the body and tail of a snake with the bird with bird's legs, wings, and chest. Its closest relative is the caudal, a feathered snake with human eyes. The most famous caudal, of course, is Quetzalcoatl, the main demigod worshipped by the Mayans and the Aztecs. And there's a basilisk featured in Harry Potter, I believe this is the third book, by the way. They dip into this mythology for their interesting characters in Harry Potter. It is also distantly related to the iguanas of South Africa. Throughout historical folklore, the basilisk is described as a deadly creature that can kill by their intense stare, which paralyzes victims with fear, and then biting it, which causes fatal convulsions. The Roman historian Pliny the Elder wrote about the basilisk in detail in his natural history book. It is also featured in bestiaries from the 12th century. At the time, this snake and bird hybrid was used as a symbol for the devil. It is reported that England suffered from a wave of attacks in the 15th century until a brave man donned a suit of mirrors, and many basilisks were killed by gazing at their own reflection in the mirrored suit. The last recorded sighting occurred in 1587 when two young girls were killed in a basement in Poland. The physician in the case believed it was the attack of a basilisk, and a convicted criminal was sent into the basement with a costume of mirrors. According to the tale, he killed a small snake-like creature believed to be a basilisk and showed it to the large crowd who had gathered outside the building. So that's one of the scariest creatures I ended up researching, and it's intriguing because as you go back into these old almanacs and diaries and encyclopedias, they're written about in a factual manner. They're not really referred to as fantasy stories. It's almost like in my second DVD, The Temples of Stone, when I was researching the dragons, I found almanacs from, you know, 1,000 years ago where they state matter-of-factly, you know, well, the weather this spring is going to be rainy, and then a dragon came and breathed fire on the church and grabbed a villager and went back to his cave. And then in the summer, we're going to have hot weather. I mean, it's mixed in with, like, mundane factual information. It's really quite stunning to read these documents, and it's hard to know what to make of it, but I can tell you that these early people did believe in these types of creatures. So, by the way, I'll pause for a moment here, and I really appreciate all of your support, and I do have two DVDs on ancient mysteries with over 100 photos. They're very fascinating. I get into all kinds of exciting stories like I'm sharing with you now. So please check out my webpage, and that is how the show is paid for and supported. I really appreciate those of you who buy my DVDs. They're great fun for parties and just to share with other people. We talk about the pyramids and Stonehenge and Easter Island and ancient monuments and creatures all around the globe. So go to my webpage, and you can buy them through PayPal. They're $20 each, and it's real easy, a real simple transaction. Please do so. And I'll ship them out to you. And my new DVD, Mystery Islands, is coming out very soon. I just saw a sneak peek myself. I'm doing final editing, and I will let you know when that one's available. So we have time for a couple more as we're winding down here. Let's talk about the griffin. I wonder how many of you know what a griffin is. So have you ever wondered what those strange, majestic animals are on the crests and seals of European royalty? This legendary symbol is called a griffin. He possesses the body of a lion, but the head of an eagle. This fearsome creature is featured in many ancient Greek statues and Babylonian murals and clay artifacts. According to legend, the griffin prefers to live in remote, mountainous areas, and they are known to prey upon horses. The Roman authority Aelian, back in 200 AD, reported that they will attack most animals, along with ripping humans to shreds. He describes how groups of humans would venture into the wilderness at night in search of their gold, but many were viciously attacked by the sharp eagle talons of the griffin. Similar to dragon mythology, the griffin hoards gold and gemstones inside of dark caves and guards them with fierceness. In Egypt, the griffin was associated with the custodial god Negral, the god of afterlife, and Ishtar is said to be the mistress of the griffins. Many royal kingdoms have placed symbols of this creature on their royal palaces, shields, and entrance gates to ward off attackers after their wealth and treasure. The Greek historian Herodotus writes about the griffin who ruled the seacoast in the northern regions of Russia and fought with men over gold and emeralds. They have been depicted widely in medieval art and are featured in bestiaries again. A more gentle version is featured in the book Alice in Wonderland. And oftentimes in children's stories, these creatures are softened up. I think of the fawn in The Lion, the Witch, and the Wardrobe is softened up as a gentle creature, and, of course, the griffin, as I just mentioned, in Alice in Wonderland. So in the United States, there's a small lake in the remote mountains north of Los Angeles that held a lake monster with a similar description of a griffin back in the 1800s. And this is a story I grew up hearing because I'm from Los Angeles, and I would hear about this every once in a while, this strange lake monster. And so I chose to write about it in my next DVD. Lake Elizabeth was settled by the Spanish ranchers who farmed the area, but were terrorized by a griffin-like creature who attacked their cattle and livestock. Don Carrillo reported in the 1830s that he heard a strange screaming sound at night that terrorized his workers. One night, a strange fire burned down every single structure around the lake. Local Spanish missionaries referred to it as El Lago del Diablo, or the Lake of the Devil. This sounds like a ridiculous story, but over the next few decades, several hard-working ranchers actually sold their properties at great discounts or simply abandoned their land in the middle of the night to escape the lake monster. Finally, in 1886, a tough rancher named Miguel Leonis shot the mysterious creature and chased it away from the lake forever. So I'm just going to tantalize you with a bit of the animal-human hybrid stories, and we'll do more on a future episode. So just in the last few minutes, I'll talk a bit about current events. As many of you know, I'm a part of the 911 Truth movement, and I saw a great lecture recently by an architect. And he studied the Twin Towers, and he concluded that they were blown up, that it was a demolition. And he studied the evidence in the dust samples, and he found traces of thermite. As most of you know, 98% of the building's rubble was shipped off to China right away, and that was illegal. That was a crime scene, and it should not have been tampered with, but the evidence was whisked away to another country. However, about 2% remained, and many people like Stephen Jones, the professor, have tested the metal, and Richard Gage, the architect, and they have concluded the presence of thermite, or explosive powder, is all throughout the metal. So please check him out. He's got a website with hundreds of engineers and architects. And if you're looking into this issue and don't really want to get involved with wacky conspiracy folks, you may like this website because it's very professional. It's very scientific. They don't get involved in who did it. That's not their job. They're simply analyzing the destruction of the Twin Towers. And a steel-framed building, of course, has never melted before or collapsed with a fire. That has never happened before, and yet it happened three times on 911, and the third building wasn't even hit by a plane. So the website is ae911truth.org. That's ae911truth.org, and the AE stands for Architects and Engineers. His name is Richard Gage. Please invite him to your town to speak. It was a fantastic presentation, and millions and millions of people are really waking up to this information, and something's got to occur. This goes way beyond the Kennedy assassination. There's a lot more film, a lot more evidence, and a lot more people who have looked into it, and free flow of information via the Internet. And then the last current event I want to leave you with tonight, and boy, I always do, I give you a jam-packed show, don't I, is that Jesse Ventura, former governor of Minnesota, has come forward. He says 911's an inside job. He actually trained in demolitions in the Navy, and he has gone on record. And I'll just leave you with a small anecdote that he said. He ran for governor as an independent in Minnesota, and the night he won, his office was crowded with 23 CIA agents. They all burst into his office. They would not give him their exact names or anything. But they demanded to know how he could possibly win as an independent, somebody outside of the Republican-Democrat stranglehold monopoly. And they were very upset that he had won, and they questioned him in an extreme manner that night, almost like the Spanish Inquisition. And he said that he found out there's CIA at every level of state government in key positions to make sure that it's only a two-party race and those third parties never get in. So please bear that in mind. It's time for politics to simplify and things to be shaken up, and things are happening. Personally, myself, I've gone off into a third party, and I'm supporting alternative candidates like Ron Paul. There definitely are solutions and alternatives out there. So please check out Jesse Ventura's latest book. He's doing a cross-country book tour. And when he was on Fox in the interview, I couldn't believe it. They lied. They said, well, there's no architects or anything who have come forward. There's no experts who have said the building was blown up. But I just gave you a website where there's hundreds and hundreds of engineers who have said that it was a demolition. So that was a big lie by the Fox News broadcasters. Anyway, I'll leave you with that. Thanks to Jack Berenger for coming on Past Shock. Please go to my my webpage. It's right on the Odyssey BBS main page for BBS Radio. You can see my picture. You can see the cover of my two DVDs, The Sands of Time and The Temples of Stone, and read all about them, and please order them and support the show. And I thank you so much for joining me this evening in our field and our study and our quest of ancient mysteries. And I will see you in 2 weeks on Odyssey. Thank you, and have a good night.